Welcome back, loyal listeners, in Prez, Cork, Ireland, and indeed all around the globe, to Season 4, Episode 2 of PVC Podcast. I'm Stephen Delaney.
And I'm Matthew Reardon.
Well, the days are beginning to stretch as the days of spring set in, and as ever, we have a brimful episode to entertain you here on the podcast by the Transition Year students of Prez. Coming up, for starters, we have an interview with Prez alumnus from 2009 who has packed a hell of a lot since he left the school. Dental surgeon, podcast creator, writer, board member of Gashka Ireland, and now pursuing his passion for theatre, film and acting, we caught up with Ali Khan.
Also on the show, Stephen, we spoke to our in-house computer science expert, Mr. Martin Garvey, and English coordinator, Mr. Shane Toomey, about their views on AI evolution and tech in the classroom.
Looking forward to hearing that, Matthew. We also sent our intrepid reporters out on the streets of Cork to gauge the public's opinion on the controversial renaming of Parky Queeve. Some heated and very interesting vox pops in there.
If that's not enough to stimulate your interest, we talk about the man of the moment, former press boy and the first Cork man to line up to pick up the Best Actor award at the Oscars on the 10th of March. Principal of Prez David Barry and former Prez English teacher William Wall discuss Cillian Murphy.
Sounds like a hell of a show, Matthew, so let's kick it off with Ali Khan. Ali recently came in Prez to talk to our sixth-year students about his life, his passions and his time in Prez. Sam Hernan is the interviewer. Over to Sam and Ali.
So, Ali Khan, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us for a chat. If I'm not mistaken, you left Prez in 2009. Mr. Olinchik tells me there was a joke at the time that if anybody can, Ali can, that you were quite an active student in the school, like thumbs in many pies nearly. But how was your time in Prez in your own experience?
Yeah, thanks very much for having me, Sam. I really appreciate it. It's great to be back in Prez. Yeah, I graduated in 2009, and yeah, I was here from 2003 to 2009. And I have to say that, like, you know, it was one of the greatest times of my life. You know, it was wonderful. I mean, I expanded so much as a human being by being here. You know, I always joke that in many ways, like, I learned to think here. I learned to perform. I learned to, you know, engage with crowd psychology. I expanded in a huge way while I was here. So it was a magnificent time. I was involved in just about anything I could be involved in to get out of class. So it was, you know, it was whether it was playing rugby, playing, you know, whether it was rowing, whether it was cricket, a captain of the cricket team here. I was student government, president of the student council, chairman of the debating society. I was drama leading, you know, one of the leads in Philadelphia, Here I Come as Gara Private. So it was just about everything. And you know what? I think that was wonderful because it was an opportunity to really, you know, expand and grow as an individual, an opportunity to kind of, you know, I think just develop my passion and what I was interested in. Because from a young age, I was always, as far as back as I can remember, I loved acting and creating and theater and all of that area. And so, you know, getting to come here and getting to kind of develop my passion and expand was wonderful. Really was. Yeah. Couldn't have said more better things about the school.
Glowing praise, really.
Yeah. So a very supportive environment. Sorry. It's also worth saying, you know, the teachers were always incredibly supportive and friendly and always looking to kind of, you know, encourage you along the way. And loads of fantastic teachers, many of which are still here, you know.
It's brilliant. And you mentioned Philadelphia Here I Come as being something that meant a lot to you when you were in the school. And I know Mr. Olinchik and Mr. Reardon, they talked about you as Gar Private in the play, of course. And acting was a passion already when you were in Prez. But then when you graduated, you went up the road to UCC to study dentistry. Was it that dentistry was another passion for you and something you'd always been interested in, or was it more seen as just a means to allow you to keep acting?
Yeah, I think for me, and perhaps it would be helpful at this point to maybe just give a little bit of background to myself and my journey. Would that be helpful?
Of course.
So I suppose I graduated from Prez in 2009, and then I went on to become a dental surgeon, studied in UCC, and then I did an oral and maxillofacial surgery residency in Cambridge University Hospitals, and then what's called the membership of the Faculty of Dental Surgeons from the Royal College of Surgeons in Edinburgh. And I did a pediatric dental residency from Children's Hospital Ireland in Crumlin. And then I had my own practice in Dublin. I was self-employed in private practice in Dublin. And concurrent to that, I was doing an executive MBA in Trinity College in Dublin. And then I sold my practice and I went to the University of Oxford and I did an MSc, a Master's in Global Governance and Diplomacy. And now where I'm at, I'm now 32 years old. And now as a 32-year-old, I've set up my own investment fund. It's called Ali Khan Holdings. And basically, the other major thing I do is I act and I'm an actor. And so basically, to answer your question, the dentistry and the investment fund and all of that stuff was very much about putting in place the structures to allow me to live the life I'm living now, which is that of an actor, an artist, a creator. Because as far back as I can remember, that's what I was passionate about. I love acting. I love it for the sake of loving it, you know? Like, I love the smell of theatres. I love engaging with audiences. I love crowd psychology. I love creating characters. I love storytelling. I love all of that stuff. And I think, and this is something I was saying to the lads downstairs in the talk I gave to some of the sixth-year students before this podcast was, you know, find a passion that you're passionate about for the sake of being passionate about that passion, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that was one of that's acting for me. I love it, you know?
It's funny, as you talk about acting, it's nearly, and almost, you nearly start glowing with happiness that it's like, it's a sense of nearly a strange kind of like aestheticism that you love acting for being nothing more than acting, that it's a passion that nothing rivals for you, I suppose, is it?
100%, yeah. And it's that thing of just like, I think when it came to the sort of vision, and this is one of the things I was talking about with the lads downstairs, and we can go into this in a second, this kind of idea of like sort of the equation I was trying to lay out for the lads around sort of contentment and happiness and living a life of passion. You know, the vision I have for acting is very much about sort of being an actor, living that life, you know, being in the theatres, the kind of old oak panel theatres, like discussing the ideas with people late into the night, you know, like engaging with audiences, being in films, being in TV, enjoying that, creating characters, really trying to master that craft, you know, and like that very much speaks to the journey I'm on. And even like where I'm going next, where I'm heading over to Oxford and London over the next couple of months. I'll be moving over to Oxford and kind of basing myself between Oxford and base myself in Oxford, and you know, London is whatever 45-50 minutes away on the train there, and kind of just setting my life up around being an actor there and engaging with that, which is going to be amazing. And it's very much about, having studied at the University of Oxford, I realized that, you know, getting to sort of live out that vision, for example, as an actor, that I got to do here in Prez or that I got to do over in Oxford, it was even better than I envisioned it would be, you know, and it really lit me up in a way that I was just super excited and super delighted. And so, yeah, I just want to kind of, you know, keep that flowing. And that's the thing I was trying to teach the lads downstairs as well, is, you know, there's a way to create that life of contentment, and, you know, it's worth having the courage to go and do it, you know.
You talk about kind of nearly that life of contentment as it's the journey towards getting that,
yeah,
as an end goal of being so content in your own life as you seem to be now, that, yeah, the acting can be so much of your life and something you're so passionate is so far above work and anything else that it's nearly not work anymore.
Yeah.
But that path you mentioned towards getting that, those steps nearly towards doing it, that's something you're kind of passionate about, nearly spreading the message about as well, is it?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, like, you know, the old adage of, you know, if you're passionate about what you do, you never work a day in your life. And I love what I do, you know, and I think that there's a real equation to putting together a life that's centered around passion. And this is something I wanted to share with the lads downstairs, and I'm really glad that I got to do so. You know, the equation goes something like this, you know, it begins with self-compassion. And once you engage in a high degree of self-compassion and self-love and really self-understanding, from there you can go to a place of authenticity and really get in touch with your authentic self. And from there you can identify what you're passionate about. From there, you can construct a compelling vision around a life that would be based around that passion. And then from there, it's just about creating that vision, bringing it into reality and, you know, creating that life of passion. And, you know, as we chat here, we can go into the different elements of that, but really that's the equation. And, you know, if you construct your life like that, you'll have a beautiful, compelling, exciting vision that you're creating, but also you'll enjoy the journey of that creation, you know, and that's been the case with my own life. And that's the way I've looked at my life. And that's the way I've set up my life. And it's wonderful. I love it. Like I thoroughly enjoy my life, you know, and it's possible, you know, and I think it's important to spread that message of positivity, because look, God knows we get enough cynicism and negativity through the 10 inches of glass and plastic in our pockets, you know, and on TV and whatever. And so it's like, you know, I think it's good to put some of those messages of sort of positivity and sort of creation into the world, you know?
Definitely. And nearly with that process, to nearly take it down to the very most fundamental level you mentioned of self-compassion, that it's something that isn't maybe talked about very much in, maybe it's the all boys school, or maybe it's society as a whole. I suppose that idea of kind of looking after yourself first before you can move on to the rest of your life, was that idea of being compassionate towards yourself and valuing your own opinions, was that always easy to you, or did you struggle with it? Or
so I think if you deconstruct that, I think I always valued my own opinions for sure, but like I was chronically hard on myself, like chronically. And it was a thing that just was not serving me to a point. Because, you know, being hard on yourself can kind of serve you at a point, right? Because you obviously, you know, you maybe work that bit harder, you reach that bit higher, et cetera. But like, there comes a point where it doesn't serve you anymore, you know? And like, there comes a point where you have to take a look and say, you have to kind of self-examine and be self-aware and kind of go, you know, what am I doing here? You know, can I be more self-compassionate? And the journey for me very much was about sort of trying to create more self-compassion and go easier on myself. And the reason I say that's important is that if you look at that equation I mentioned again earlier, self-compassion is the pathway to authenticity. Because when you're compassionate towards yourself, when you enhance your sense of self-love, your self-understanding, et cetera, your opinion about your own life is only going to go up. Because fundamentally, like, while it's important to have, you know, teachers and friends and people around you that are going to support you, you have to be the one to put forward the opinion. Like, it doesn't really matter what they think or what, you know, what I think or whatever. What matters is about what you think about yourself and your life and what you're passionate about. Now, the way to get there, where you're valuing that opinion and you're putting that first, is by engaging in self-compassion. Because from there, you can start engaging with authenticity. And from authenticity, really understanding yourself and getting a true sense of who you are, from there, you can get a sense of what you're passionate about. And then you create the vision to make that passion into reality, and you create that life around that vision. And that's kind of the way that works, you know? And I mean, like, authenticity, I'll tell you a good story about authenticity, right? Like, when I went to Oxford, I always look at it like, I was there for 50 weeks, so just short of a year. And the way I look at it, it was like 50 lifetimes in 50 weeks, you know? So I made a rule that I was like, I got to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, got to go to the gym, got to do my college work or whatever, but then I can do whatever I want. You know, whether it's, you know, engaging with, you know, acting, theater, you know, socializing, formal dinners, going out, whatever I was doing, you know, just go and have a good time, enjoy yourself, have fun. But I got to get up at 6 a.m., right? And that idea, and I guess that sort of mentality was basically centered around this idea of like, I went there with the idea that like, I wanted to get in touch with my authentic self. And I was going to turn everything about myself up to a million and let those toggles land where they will. But the idea was to get in touch with my authentic self, right? And like, I always knew I wanted to be an actor, but I had gotten to a point where I was kind of like, I need to really tap deeper into who I am as a person, because it's going to make me a better person. It's going to make me a better professional. It's going to make me a better actor, et cetera, right? So, and I'll never forget it. Like, the I was walking around the corner of Broad Street in Oxford. And anyone who's been to Oxford knows Broad Street and how wonderful it is, because it just sort of opens up in front of you and suddenly you've got sort of the Sheldonian there and you've got Balliol College and you've got Trinity College, et cetera, right? And it's absolutely an incredible scene as such when it opens up. And you've got an old haunt of mine as well, the King's Arms on the corner, which is a place of much merriment and banter for many a night while I was there. But I remember distinctly turning that corner onto Broad Street. I remember what I was wearing, what I was carrying, what the weather was like. And then bang, I had that moment where all of the work I had done on trying to get in touch with my authentic self over the course of that year, those 50 lifetimes collided into one sense, one moment of just authenticity and a sense of like self-understanding. And I had a deeper sense of who I was as a person. And there was no better place to go from that point, because I was so in touch with who I was. And then, you know, like right after that, I set up the investment fund and then, you know, and live the life I do now as an actor, you know, and it's been, it was a wonderful moment though, because it was the culmination of a huge amount of effort that went in to get to that point. And it was incredible. I mean, it really was. And like, I've gotten to the stage now where obviously when I first set up the investment fund, it was at the stage where obviously I had to work full time on it, but now I've set up a team and a structure so that I really only have to work on it for about an hour a day, you know, and, you know, whatever admin that's required, close certain financial positions, open others. And the rest of my time is just spent acting and creating and doing that work, you know. So authenticity is an incredible part of that journey, you know. And that was a fun story around authenticity that I enjoyed. It was a really fun moment, I must say.
And in Oxford, was that... how you talk about Oxford, it seems like it's clearly a place that means an awful lot to you, like with the history you have with it, how you,
yeah,
it sounds so cliche, but how you nearly found yourself Oxford.
Yeah, yeah.
And you mentioned you're moving back soon.
Yeah.
Is that a continuance of that journey, or is it kind of the next step in the acting and the...
Yeah, it's Oxford's magic. Like, it's just magic. And you know, it's like, it's, I had such a vision of what it would be like, and it was part of my journey, and I wanted to go there. And every expectation I had about Oxford was not just met, but completely exceeded by my time there, you know? I think it was an absolutely amazing time in my life, and it's an amazing place, because when you go there, what's fantastic about it is anything is possible, and you're surrounded by human beings who basically have believed that for like most of their life, and then they all come together and you have the most wonderful conversations with people. And it's like, what's interesting as well is you have people who are truly passionate about what they're doing. So you could be sitting in the King's Arms or the Half Moon or Turf Tavern or one of the many, many or the Bear, or one of the many, many ancient spots of wisdom and learning that exist, not just in the classroom, but outside the classroom too. And you could be sitting there and you could be, you know, reading a book about, say, Daniel O'Connell or something, you know, someone who I found very interesting, is a great, like, obviously, statesman. And then someone could come up to you and then they could be like, you know, tell me about that book. And you'd be like, well, it's about Daniel O'Connell, blah, blah, blah. And they'd be like, they'd be trying to, within 2 minutes, you're sort of comparing their thesis on, say, like the governing dynamics of a certain, you know, subject within physics to the economic policy of Daniel O'Connell or his proposed economic policies, you know? And it's like this kind of multi-industry, multiple sort of layered, multi-layered thinking allows you to really expand your mind. And so my thesis when I was at Oxford was around this idea of governing dynamics and understanding the kind of the dynamics that govern our society. Like, one of my great heroes is John Nash, who, you know, if you've seen A Beautiful Mind, you've seen an excellent portrayal of the character. And like, he's a wonderfully interesting human being because that was what he was fascinated by. And you come to learn that what it does really, Oxford, is it copper fastens the idea in your mind that anything is possible. Because people are just moving across industry. They're having incredible conversations. You know, you're going to talks, you're going to shows, you're going to whatever. And, you know, you're having a great time the whole time. I mean, you know, dining clubs upon roofs of the university, like stuff like that. You know, I mean, it's just an incredible time. And so for me, it was an incredibly fulfilling time because of how expansive it was. And it really copper fastened that idea that anything is possible. And the reason I'm moving back is because I loved it there, you know. And then also, I suppose you've access to London as well. And it's a great place to set up if you're looking to be an actor because of the access to those two cities. And yeah, I'm looking forward to getting back there and continuing that journey. And what's awesome is that if you're an alumnus of the university, so if you've studied in the University of Oxford, you still have full access to the libraries and the colleges.
Oh, wow.
So it's awesome. Yeah, because you know, they have that college system where all the colleges make up the university. And so you still have access to everything. And I'm a lifetime member of the Oxford Union as well. So like I can, you know, still have full access to all of that as well. So it's, yeah, I can't say enough good things about the place. It's an incredibly, you know, if you're thinking about where to study or if you're thinking about visiting a pretty inspirational place, then yeah, Oxford, give it a go. Would highly recommend.
And I suppose to go from Oxford and the melting pot it was to for nearly a little subsect of society that had such an importance on learning and in arts and all different forms of learning nearly, to peel that right back again to Prez nearly, that when you were in Prez, it seems like such a simple question given the depth of the conversation, but were you a good student in that, obviously, dentistry in UCC, it was in
high points,
CAO
terms
and everything, so successful, and to study in Oxford and everything, was academics incredibly important to you, again, as a means to following on that vision and that?
Oh, 100%. I love academics. See, the thing is like, if you love what you're doing, you enjoy working at it, right? And you excelling in it becomes easier. And I loved academics. I loved what I was studying. And it was a big dream of mine to go to the University of Oxford. Because for me, because I would be very academic and I would really value knowledge and wisdom to a very high degree, it was a dream of me to go to the University of Oxford because for me, it felt like the pinnacle. Like, you know, it's, you know, I would say it's, you know, the greatest university in the world. And, you know, I mean, certainly in the Western world, it's the oldest, you know, I mean, people have been taught at the University of Oxford for about 1,000 years at this point. And you feel that imbued in every brick of Clepsham stone in the city, you know, and it's sort of everywhere when you're there. And like, so it was a great dream of mine. And to go there and to study there was incredibly exciting for me. And the course I was doing, actually, it's the hardest course to get into in the University of Oxford. It's like, I think it's like about 650 people apply every year and 25 get in. So it's really, but I enjoyed that challenge. You know, I kind of relished that because for me, it was like getting to master the craft of academics was like getting into that course and getting into that course in that university. And I really relished that, you know, and that's kind of, so I would have said that, I would have been excellent academically here in school and then in university and over in Oxford as well. And like, and kind of in the courses that I would have done in the, you know, in the dentistry or the executive MBA or in the MFDS, any of those things leading up to it, I would have always excelled academically. And certainly while I was at the University of Oxford as well, doing the master's there, I excelled academically. And it was an enjoyable environment to excel in. You really relish the opportunity to learn. And they encourage debate as well, which is really excellent and something I really, really enjoyed. And like, that's kind of where I do enjoy mastering a craft. And thoroughly enjoy mastering a craft, and sort of that's where I find myself now with the acting, where I'm eager to master this craft. And so, yeah, like that's kind of, you know, if we look at that equation again, you know, you go from self-compassion to authenticity to this place of passion. And where passion came in, and I thought that was really interesting, was that the way I would encourage people to try and get in touch with their passion is, you know, once you've engaged with that self-compassion and that authenticity, and begin the process of trying things. And if you compare, say, this school and the University of Oxford, two places where I just got to try a myriad of things and was supported in those efforts. And that really helps you cultivate your passion. You know, when you get to try different things, you're like, oh, I like that. You know, I mean, I'll never forget the feeling of being on stage playing Gar Private here. And you get on stage and you feel that electricity of the theater, the crowd, they're listening, you're taking them on a journey psychologically, emotionally, they're going through that journey with you. You get a taste of that and then you're like, oof, you know what? I think I like this, you know? And that's kind of the way it is, you know? It's like, that's how you develop your passion. And so that's what I would say to people is try things, you know, engage with things, see what lights you up, you know? And that's really how you develop that passion. It was the same at Oxford. You know, I expanded so much, you know, in so many different ways. And, you know, that was really exciting to me in terms of getting to expand like intellectually, academically, as an artist, as an actor, you know, really getting to kind of push those things out, you know, even physically, really just kind of like seeing what I could do, flexing those muscles, really kind of trying things out, you know. And it was an incredibly exciting time. And so that's what I'd say to people is that, you know, passion, that's that next step, you know, in that equation.
So that's the passion element covered then. But the next step in your equation, it was vision and then creation. Yeah. Where does that go next?
So I think once you've established a sense of what you're passionate about, and I would always stress that it's sort of passion for the sake of passion, you know, being whatever it is that you really care about, love that for the sake of loving it in a very kind of authentic and true way. From there, I think it's about creating a vision. Like you've got to create a vision for yourself. What is how are you going to make this happen? And that's got to be, you know, it's got to be, you've got to take care of the practicalities, but then you also got to make sure that it lights you up and that it's compelling. And what does it look like? Like I'm a very visual person. So for me, like I had a very clear picture in my head of like, what is it that being an actor is going to look like? How do I want it to feel? How do I want it to look? And, you know, for me, it was so much about sort of like, as I said, like that oak panel theater, the exchange of ideas deep into the evening, crowd working with crowds, being in film, being on TV, et cetera, et cetera. And that very much informed in many ways my move to Oxford and, you know, London nearby as well, is that it's about creating and bringing that vision to life. So once you have that vision, then it's about sort of creating a life around that vision and around that passion. And, you know, there's a couple of things I want to say here. First, I want to talk about support, because it's important to say that, like, one of the greatest things I got from this school, from Prez, was the support of friends and the support of teachers. There are some wonderful teachers in this school, and they were always incredibly supportive of whatever it is I was doing. And, you know, I'm probably going to leave some names out, but I will name a few. I'll say, you know, Mr. Olinchik, Mr. Sheehan, Mr. Jones, Mr. Buckley, you know, Miss Galan, Miss O'Donoghue. And I would say as well, there's, you know, Mr. Philpott, I mentioned him, and there's a myriad of teachers that I'm definitely forgetting. But, you know, these people were all incredibly encouraging and always very helpful. And I would also want to mention my old cricket coach, Dermot Gilton, who passed away a couple of years ago. And the thing about Dermot Gilton as well is he taught me so much about having the courage to be kind. And kindness is a very important thing. And I think that not only do you learn about kindness from Galt, we used to call him Galt, was his nickname, but you also learned more about how to be more self-compassionate. You know, it was something that I definitely needed to work on, and being less hard on myself. And that was incredibly beneficial. And I'll tell you something, just a quick story about kindness. It always comes back to you, you know. As I said, Galt passed away a couple of years ago, and the story always touches me, and I might get a bit emotional even talking about it now, is when he was in the hospital at the end, two of the doctors that were looking after him right at the end were two cricket players from Prez that he taught, that he coached. And that's just perfect, you know. Then, like, artistically, I would say that Mr. Ahern was an incredible influence playing Gar Private here and sitting under the learning tree of Mr. Hearn, who has done everything in acting, you know, Broadway, the West End, film, TV, everything. And to have a person like that directing you and teaching you about the life. I mean, to this day, I still go to Mr. Hearn for advice and he's still a mentor. So to have that as well was absolutely incredible. The last thing I'd say is about creation. And I would just say to the students, just a quote that always sort of lands with me, and it's something that I'll paraphrase here, but it's a quote from the American president, Theodore Roosevelt, which was basically that it's not the critic who counts, not the man on the sideline jibing at the man in the arena. Rather, it is the man in the arena whose face is marred by dust and blood and sweat, who is attempting great victory. That is the person who counts. So my challenge to any student listening to this, or to anybody listening to this, is to have the courage to live a life of passion and contentment. The courage to use this equation, bring it into your everyday life and act upon it. Because if you do that, if you have that courage, you won't be among those timid souls who, as Thoreau says, live lives of quiet desperation. No, you won't be one of those men. You'll be one of the men who sit among the gods and create a life of magnificence for yourself, a life of contentment and a life of passion.
Leigh-Kan, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. That's a perfect note to end on.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
The fascinating Leigh-Kan there, interviewed by Sam Hearn. We wish Ali the best of luck in forging a new career in acting and are suitably awed by his life achievements already at the age of only 32. He's some energy, isn't he, Stephen?
For sure, Matthew. It's making me tired just thinking about it. Now, moving on. There's been a lot of talk over the last number of years about artificial intelligence and how it's going to change the workplaces of the future. Here on the PBC podcast, however, we decided to look at AI in the classroom here in Prez and how technology has impacted and will impact the school. Ben Collin and Barry O'Connor caught up with computer science teacher Martin Garvey and English teacher Shane Toomey to get the teacher's perspective.
Today I'm joined by fellow podcaster Ben Collin to discuss the rising star of the tech world, AI. We're discussing how it affects on education, creativity, and how it should be used, if at all. Ben, can you explain just what ChatGPT is?
Well, Barry, one piece of AI that has become especially prominent within our current educational system and as a whole, is known as ChatGPT. ChatGPT is an advanced AI system that, with the usage of prompts from its user, can generate essays, stories, can answer questions. And today, currently within our educational system, we've been finding this to be utilized by a wide array of students.
Have you ever used the system yourself?
Actually, I have, yes, Barry. I use it to help organize my study schedule during the junior cert.
How'd that work out? Did you have to use much input or was it simple?
Well, I did have to use a certain degree of prompts as the AI is still kind of in its developmental stage, but it was still able to more or less come up with it by itself.
Now, from a student's perspective, do you believe ChatGPT and other systems like it should be allowed to use in schools?
Well, Barry, I think it's inevitable that students will be utilizing it within the next couple of years, given how accessible it is. So that's why I think that the only logical course of action would be to implement it in the educational system so as it can be better controlled.
But do you believe it should be prohibited in any way or free-for-all sort of way?
I don't think that there should be a free-for-all. I definitely do fear how the usage of AI in schools could affect the development of critical thinking and creativity skills amongst our students. However, I do think that perhaps it could be a force for good. I mean, there's many powerful educational tools apart from ChatGPT that have been already created involving AI.
Interesting way of looking at it. Now, to give us some history on AI, we have our local computer scientist, Mr. Garvey. Thanks for joining us.
How's it going? So obviously you're chatting there about ChatGPT, and that would be it's what's known as a generative form of AI. And it's kind of really the first form of AI that a lot of people from a lot of age groups would be very kind of familiar with, maybe the overarching idea of it, and find it very easy to kind of use in terms of, like you said, you just put in a simple prompt, you can come up with study plans, you can come up with essays, you can come up with like examples of code, like it does a whole lot of things. But like, this is like it's taken a long time to get to this point. Like AI first would have come about in around the early 1950s. And even then, like if you think back, like if you go back to even ancient times, there would have been these ideas of like automatons or, you know, machines that could think like people, but obviously didn't exist. So like in the 1950s, 60s, this started to come about. There was money put into it. You would have got the first version of what you'd call a chatbot, which was called Eliza, I think. Excuse me. And that was kind of put to the test, or put to what was called the Turing test. So the Turing test is essentially this test that AI would be put to see if it can pass for a human. So like someone would blindly be talking to or asking questions to a machine, and they'd have to decide, is it the machine answering them, or is it actually someone else responding, you know, that they can't see? So that'd be called a Turing test, and all AI would be put to this test. So one of the first examples of machines being put to this test would have been Eliza, which had been a chatbot back in the 1960s, and it fairly quickly failed that test. But, you know, what actually became very useful is for people in college who were starting to learn how to code, starting to come up with this idea of like machine learning, you know, deep learning, all these terms started to emerge in the 60s and 70s. And this Eliza, this simple chatbot, like became kind of almost like a gimmick, but it brought people, like the wider public, kind of, you know, this kind of brought this idea of AI to the wider public, where they were able to kind of say, okay, well, maybe I can ask a computer to do something and it will do this, you know. And this actually set a lot of expectations on AI and machine learning going into the 70s and into the 80s. And I actually found out that, like, when these expectations weren't being met, there was what was called like an AI winter in the 80s, where like all investment, put money into it, thinking how we could use AI going into the future, that all started to drop off. Because these expectations of what AI was going to do, like, were just not being met. And it was only as we moved into the 90s that things like machine learning started to become very common, or kind of more widely talked about and studied. And the reason for this is because large data sets were starting to appear. And like the idea of computers and their processing power being able to kind of process or analyze these big data sets and look for hidden patterns. You know, and that actually kind of started to promote like businesses, you know, colleges, like medical world, all this kind of started to look, see if they could use this machine learning, this AI, to actually recognize patterns, you know. And this progressed all through the 90s into the early 2000s, when there was a machine called, the name of it's gone off out of my head now, but it was used by IBM to try and win the quiz show Jeopardy. You heard of Jeopardy?
Yeah. Not that young.
Okay, right. Oh, yeah. So the machine was called Watson. So I think it was in 2010, 2011. Watson was just cleaning the floor with all competitors. No one could beat it, you know? And like, this was actually coming from, when we think of AI, we think of like, you know, machines or systems coming up with the ideas themselves. But like, we're only kind of getting to that now. Like, earlier forms of AI would have been working off like set data sets, you know?
As a computer science, would you fear for how AI is going? Not exactly a Skynet situation, but something similar to it.
In terms of like just how it's going to be used worldwide?
Like automation of jobs, kind of how it affects, it's going to be, affect people going forward.
Well, I think if we go back to the industrial age, like that was the beginning of automation of the jobs. Yeah. You know, skilled jobs will probably always need skilled people in some way. You do still need people. Maybe jobs will veer away from, say, being a consultant doctor to being a data analyst, where you actually would analyze medical data. Same in the crime world, like AI being used to predict where certain crime hotspots could be, you know, working out aviation patterns, working out machinery, like the, you know, like how you'd manufacture machinery in maybe different ways. Like the chemical world is a big one, and this is actually maybe a big fear. Well, big fear might be just me overstating it, but like this idea that you could use generative AI to like come up with different chemical combinations.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Do you know? But like that also could work in a helpful way. You might come up with new materials that might be helping the manufacturing industry. Do you know? So I wouldn't fear AI, no, not at all. I don't think anyone should. But they think that like we're going to stay with the status quo now of where there'll always be these jobs or whatever jobs are at the moment. Like that's not going to, that can't happen. Like jobs are going to change. Like if you go back 100 years and someone said they were an AI coder, AI programmer, web scraper, like they wouldn't know what you're saying. But those jobs are there now because of that industry, like, do you know?
Yeah, I suppose progress always keeps going.
Yeah.
Thanks, Mr. Garvey, for your opinion. Now, we also have here Mr. Toomey from the English department to give us the teacher's perspective on how AI is being used in the classroom. Thanks for joining us.
No problem. Anytime. It's funny how Mr. Garvey's on about some of that kind of stuff, and it's very much how I would feel about it. Like, I remember, I'm old enough to remember that, like, when the internet came around, when internet became common in homes, and I remember not many of us, maybe in my class and stuff, we wouldn't have all had the internet, and then like we were using that for playing games and listening to music, all that kind of stuff. But as time went on over the years, and we got used to using it as a tool, and I think ChatGPT is going to be exactly the same thing as that. I think we live, as Mr. Garvey was saying there, in an always changing world, and I think it's no different for teachers. I think there's always going to be tools that kids are going to find to use. There's no point in being naive about it. Students have been using ChatGPT for at least a couple of years, I would say anyway. It's been around, it's been always developing and always improving. And I just think we kind of have to be aware of that. It's the same, as I said, as the internet before. We had to adapt and change curriculum. We had to adapt and change teaching methodologies. And we're going to have to do exactly the same thing now. I think with all these things, you kind of have to embrace them. I do think as well, like, I suppose with ChatGPT, given the nature of it, it is always developing itself. There's, I think, the furthest or the nearest that it comes in terms of using data from that it kind of trawls is 2021 or something like that. So at some point, that's going to become 2022 and 2023 very, very quickly. There's the whole exponential improvement given how it works. So, I mean, the more data that's out there, the faster it's going to learn, the faster it's going to improve. And it's going to become even more mainstream than it already is. I think somebody mentioned earlier on about the creativity aspect of it. It's a big part of English, I suppose, from a personal perspective as a subject. And it certainly could damage the creativity in English. I certainly see it with some students there who are all of a sudden some of the greatest writers, the greatest contemporary writers that that we could ever hope to produce in the school. But I mean, it is an invaluable tool in terms of helping you with studying, with the research, things like that. So I think if we could find a middle ground, it would be great. I also think, like everything, you need to do a bit of fact checking. You need to use a lot of common sense when using any kind of tool, particularly digital tools like that. Because if you're, you know, it's important to use the word naive again, I suppose. It's important not to be naive enough to just believe everything that gets typed out in front of you and to just use that without putting a bit of thought behind that. So I think, as I said, adaptation is a big thing there for us, for teachers. Students are already ahead of the curve in using this. So I think if we can all just kind of embrace it and do our best with it, I think it could be a very positive thing actually for education in general.
So do you think there should be any prohibition on how it's used, like in the classroom, or just let them have it?
I don't know, but I don't think it's ever a good idea to just let them have it, because that usually works out in a very negative way for teachers. But I would say there's a lot of project-based things, and people are saying that could be problematic in terms of students using their own thoughts, opinions, ideas, rather than just getting ChatGPT or something similar to generate that for you. But in terms of, like, you can't walk into an exam and use ChatGPT. So like I know there's still the rote learning and all that, which we don't like, but I mean, you still have to use your own thoughts, your own mind in an exam situation to deal with the questions that you haven't seen before and to find ways around those. So you can't just be relying on ChatGPT in the same way you can't just be relying on the internet as it stands to do your exams for you. As I said, understandably, the projects are an issue. I don't think we've kind of maybe figured out how we're going to deal with that just yet. Maybe we'll have to figure out different ways of approaching projects. Maybe we'll have to have a look at how the types of projects that students are asked to do. But I suppose, look, you go into the real world, are you going to say, well, he wasn't use ChatGPT in school, so won't use it now in the real world? I mean, not at all. You're going to use every tool at your disposal. So I think it's important that the education environment that we provide actually sets students up for what the real world is going to be when we're not there to hold your hands and, you know, kind of guide you through it like that.
Oh, that's a fair way of looking at it, I suppose. Well, folks, I think that's all the time we have. Thanks for joining us and hope you all have a great day. Very interesting, Mr. Toomey. Thanks for that. Now I'm going to go around the table again and just ask, what do you people think is the best and worst thing that might happen to AI in the next 10 years? Your fears and your hopes. Ben Colin, you first.
Well, for me personally, I think that the best way to describe AI is change. Change is not necessarily positive or negative, and I think with the course of AI, we can probably see a bit of both. My greatest fear is how it's going to affect the actual quality of the people that we're going to be producing in the workforce. I mean, I did mention the facts earlier about, you know, critical thinking, creativity. And though, again, I guess maybe in the future, probably a lot of jobs you'll be working with AI. So I guess my greatest hope would be that AI could be used for that to maybe help kind of improve jobs in a way in which people still get to keep theirs.
We're looking at Mr. Garvey. I know you said you don't really shouldn't be afraid of it, but any fears at all?
My biggest fear, like, and probably biggest because it was, I don't know, off the top of my head really, would just be like laziness that could come into, like Ben was saying there, maybe the workforce, even like students, where you're like, if you feel you have at the touch of a button, or like if you just type in a few words, you're going to get out the answer you want. Like, that's going to create like a laziness, like, you know? I feel it would. Like, I know personally for me, if I felt I could just press a button every day and it would give me my lessons, give me this, like,
easy way out,
yeah. Like, it was going to happen. Like, but like in terms of like positivity, like one of the big things I'd feel is a concept called computational thinking. And I believe like alongside numeracy, literacy, this is going to become in the future, like one of these foundational pillars of education across all subjects. And computational thinking is really all about like, taking a problem, and that problem could be like whether it's developing complex software or how I write an essay in English, and breaking that problem down into smaller problems until you get to a problem you can solve. And then that solution to the smaller problem helps build up the solution to the bigger problem. Now, what's that got to do with AI? Well, if you link it to ChatGPT, you're saying, like, if I want to type in an instruction for it to give me an essay, or if I want to type in an instruction for it to give me code, like, if you want to get the best answer, you need to actually understand the problem. You know, you need to be able to break that problem down into the smaller components so you can actually ask ChatGPT or whatever generative AI it is to answer those smaller questions. And then you can actually put those solutions together yourself. So like, even though you mightn't be directly coming up with the essay or directly coming up with the code or directly coming up with whatever the solution is, like if you deeply understand that problem by getting all the different solutions, you can actually put it together to create like a working very good solution to a problem. You know what I mean? So developing computational thinking, and I see it already with like 4th years, like CVG, I definitely see it in my 5th and 6th years from a year ago, like where it's like, oh, ChatGPT is the business, like it's going to do this. And all of a sudden they give me code they don't understand. Whereas now I see it in my 5th years doing projects, obviously everyone's naturally going to go to ChatGPT. And now I can see some of their code has like just jumped on, but hasn't jumped on without them not understanding, if that makes sense. They know they're at 6 year level coding because they've learned to understand the problem they're asking ChatGPT and then understand the solution. So it's actually reinforced their learning. Do you know what I mean? Rather than just being a blank answer you can throw out there. Like.
Using it as a learning aid.
Definitely.
Mr. Toomey, any hopes or fears?
I think both of them would be probably the same answer to both. It's kind of where it goes to next. Some really good points there, I think. And having watched way too many science fiction movies, there's obviously the whole Terminator thing and there's the whole Skynet thing. But in terms of fears, it's at what point does, you know what I was saying about maybe fact-checking and not being too naive and not just being using what you're presented with all the time. What if these AI tools decide to feed us misinformation for some reason, whatever that might be? There's a whole question about self-awareness and things like that. So somewhere between the Terminator movies and where we are now, somewhere in the middle is probably not a, maybe quite the worry. Maybe in a not too distant future, who knows? In terms of the positives, again, in terms of what AI can do that we are unable to do, the theoretical problem solving and all that kind of stuff, in terms of allowing scientific advances, even medical advances, things like that, it should theoretically in a couple of years be able to operate at a far higher level than any humans on this planet. So it'll be interesting to see what it can provide us in terms of the next steps in humanity going forward, I think.
All right, fair enough. All right, thanks you all for joining me, and that's all time we have for today, listeners. Hope you all have a great day.
Intriguing interview there on AI and tech in the classroom. A big thanks to Mr. Garvey, Mr. Toomey, and of course, Ben and Barry. Food for thought, certainly, Matthew. So, what have we got next?
Well, we've just looked at what the future and AI might have in store for us, Stephen. But on our next segment, we are looking at what happens when history and modernity clash. The renaming of Páirc Uí Chaoimh has garnered a lot of headlines and trends on social media recently. We have special interest here in Prez, of course. The late Páirc Uí Chaoimh, whom the stadium was named after, once taught in Prez as a young man before leaving in 1921. He later became a renowned GAA administrator. We sent our crew out to Paul Street and North Main Street to ask the Cork public their view on the renaming controversy. Roll it there.
So my views on SuperValu Park. I find it demeaning. I find the whole kind of ownership of tradition of Cork GAA and the connectivity with Páirc Uí Chaoimh as our domestic stadium and the stadium of the Cork people, I find the whole thing very demeaning, trying to make a few cheap euros on a change of a name that's kind of clouded in materialism, even naming it SuperValu Park, very unintelligent and no thought went into it. Even if they were going to go down the SuperValu route to name it SuperValu Páirc Uí Chaoimh, but to totally move away from the heartbeat and the meaning of the stadium. I mean, it was a huge transition going from the old stadium to the new, and it was modernization, and it created a sense of rejuvenation, and this has soiled it a little, and hopefully they will reassess and rethink, because the monies being gained for this is beyond minimal. It won't have any impact on the debts that are being paid, and it's just caused a lot of consternation for many generations of people who adore and love Cork GAA. So not only are we experiencing a lull in performance and a frustration in not winning All-Irelands or Munster titles, now they are diluting the very meaning of what Cork GAA stands for.
Yeah, I suppose people have mixed opinions on it. It's bringing in a lot of money for the game, I suppose, but there is a lot of history behind the name, and it's been going for a lot of years, so people might be against that. Personally, I'm not too against it, but I can understand the history behind it. So, yeah.
I think it's just nice to keep it as like what it is already, like the name it's like known as. Like, can't see a lot of people like calling it by like SuperValu or anything. Like, I think it's just like nice as what it is.
We left at its name at the moment. It's the same as Musgrave Park was changed to, what's the name, to Virginia or to Virginia. I don't believe that. I still class it as Musgrave Park, and I class the athletic grounds as Páirc Uí Chaoimh.
It's a disgrace. What's going on? Because everything will be gone. I don't know, do people realise what's going on here at all? Everything, history and everything, is going to be wiped out. And keep the name, because Croke Park will be next. Semple Stadium, the Gaelic grounds in Limerick, they're all historic. They're part of what we are. To change it to a cheap sounding name like SuperValu Park.
I guess Páirc Uí Chaoimh has always been Páirc Uí Chaoimh. That's the way it's been since I was growing up, like, you know. Like, that's, like, it was, like, that's the name it was when I was playing my last, like, GA game in there, but when it was the old Páirc Uí Chaoimh as well, like, so can't really change it, like.
Well, I'm from the Rubbery fraternity. So if you parallel what's happening in Páirc Uí with Musgrave Park, and it's been called a lot of things since, but amongst the rugby people, it'll always be Muzzer. So I dare say whatever you call the great facility that's on Blackrock, it'll always be the athletic ground. So I think you can call it what you like, and all the better if someone pays you, because you have to be pragmatic too. But amongst the people who know, they will always refer to it, and people will know what they're referring to.
Self, no, I think it diminishes Páirc Uí Chaoimh, although I understand that branding is important. And possibly if I knew how much Super Value were paying over the next 3 or 5 years, that might change my mind, because Páirc Uí Chaoimh has a lot of financial trouble. So perhaps there's a lack of information as to whether it's worthwhile.
Right up to Andrew DeChillier. Yeah, so I think it's a bit of a change. Like, you know, a lot of places have sponsorships like that. I think it's just, since Super Value is more of a, you know, like, you look at it as like a house brand, they fill your fridge, wouldn't be as well known. Like, you look at like the Allianz Arena at Bayern Munich, and you look at Spotify Camp Nou, since they're bigger, like more global brands, I think they're kind of stand out too. It's more of a like a ring to the name. I think Super Value, since it's a local brand, you know, people think, oh, why Super Value Park? And I think there's a lot of history as well to name Páirc Uí Chaoimh. I think it was a bit controversial, but like, that's the way sports have gone. They need money, they need funding, so it has to be done really at the same time. So it's just Super Value Park is what it is now, I guess. Yeah.
I don't agree with it, I'll be honest with you, because why break what's not broken? And the man that was in jail before, his name deserves to be there. And I just don't agree with it. You know what I mean? That's it.
I'd be strongly against it, because I think preserving history of the local area is important, and for the money it's not worth it.
Yeah, I'd be strongly against it, because it's nice to have a bit of history around how we name our stadiums and important landmarks, and hearing the history behind Páirc Uí Chaoimh just makes it more interesting.
I just Super Value sounds if you're going shopping, okay, and if I'm going to a match or whatever, I'm not going to do my shopping. Shopping sounds like work. The other is meant to be enjoyable and relaxing. So they're my thoughts. Okay.
So to think that commercialism would take precedence over the importance of our heritage and culture, maintaining a historical link to the past and the value of Páirc Uí Chaoimh to its environment and to sport, would be such a shame if we lost it to commercialism. So I hope it doesn't happen. But I'm sure sense in the GAA will prevail, and a sense of duty to the past and to link it to the present will be maintained. I hope.
Do you have any view on Páirc Uí Chaoimh being renamed to Super Value Park?
Yeah, I don't think they should rename it, no. I think it's ridiculous naming it after a shop. It shouldn't be renamed whatsoever, no. Maybe after a former Cork player or something, but not after a supermarket. I think it's an insult to the GAA, it is. And I'd hate to see them renaming Croke Park, which they'll probably try and do as well. So,
Thank you very much. Do you have any thoughts on Páirc Uí Chaoimh?
Would you believe now, I've only back from Malta, I'm living there for 2 years, so I didn't even know there was a change. So,
really?
Yeah, honestly, so I'm really sorry. So,
oh no, that's
no,
fine.
Okay.
Do you think it's a good idea? Do you think it should be changed about the history, or do you think it needs to be changed?
I think we need to hold on to our Cork history. I think it's something that's dying out. I think of our history and what Cork meant, and I think there's sometimes too many changes, and I know you have to change with the times, but you also have to keep your cultural background and where you're from and what Cork really represents.
Yeah.
Oh. So, I mean, Super Value Park doesn't sound very nice. Like, would you change Croke Park? Like,
no.
Well, there you are. Yeah. And it's your grounds, like.
It's the grounds of Cork City, like, and it's obviously known as Páirc Uí Chaoimh.
Yeah.
So. I mean, it's Páirc Uí Chaoimh because it's the traditional name of the place, and it's always been known as Páirc Uí Chaoimh.
Yeah.
That's my say on it.
What do you think of the renaming of Páirc Uí Chaoimh?
Well, I think everybody seems to be doing it now. Dolphin is Virgin Media Park, so if the Chaoimh family are happy with it, everything is okay. Mm-hmm. You know?
Perfect. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hi.
are your views on the changing of a Super Value Park, the naming?
I think putting Super Value in any part of it just doesn't sound good.
Yeah.
Do you have any reasons? Like Parque Cuive sounds to me, it's part of history or something, and it's always been Parque Cuive, and I've gone to matches down there, and I just think it shouldn't be changed, to be honest with you.
So do you have any strong views on the changing of Parque Cuive to Super Value Park?
I think it should be left the name as it is without changing it to Super Value Park.
Well, the public are pretty clear there, Matthew. Vox Populi would appear to strongly favour retaining the name of Padraig Ó Cuaoimh. We interviewed before the current deal was struck and a compromise has since been reached. Super Value Parque Cuive is, of course, the new name of the stadium for the next 10 years. We will let it stand for now because it is now time for us to move on to our last segment and the man of the moment. What's coming up, Matthew?
The man of the moment indeed, Stephen. Golden Globe winner and favourite to take home the Oscar in March. We are all suitably proud of Cillian Murphy here in Prez. Recently, our principal David Barry joined Mick Mulcahy on Red FM to speak about Cillian, and his former English teacher here in Prez, William Wall, also joined Mick to discuss both Cork's and Prez's golden boy.
And David Barry is the principal of Presentation Brothers College. Thank you for holding, David, and good morning to you.
Good morning, Mick. How are you?
I'm good. Now, Cillian spent 6 years with you guys in Prez, did his Leaving Cert in 1995. Tell me a little about interactions there and memories on the ground of him.
I suppose, first and foremost, the school would just want to wish Cillian and his family great congratulations on his wonderful achievement on his, receiving the Oscar nomination yesterday. Yeah, as you said, Mick, he attended the school for 6 years and completed his Leaving Cert in 1995. And he went on to study law in UCC. So like all pupils here, he would have played a bit of rugby, maybe in the junior years. But in transition year then, his love of the arts sort of came to the fore. And that was probably due in some way to our TY coordinator at the time, Liz Kerwin, who brought in another past pupil, Pat Kiernan, from the theatre group Cork Ó Duirce, and they set up a drama module. Now, Cillian participated in this, and I suppose it might be from there that he was noticed by Pat from Cork Ó Duirce. And Cillian was also involved in bands in the school. He played with his brother Paddy and a number of other pupils, and they played lunchtime gigs in the school. So really, I'd say from transition year on, he sort of got the bug, I suppose, for the arts and performing. And he went on later to do that in college and on into his career. I suppose in school, he was a good student. The teachers that I've spoken to that taught him, now they're all retired and have left now, but they said that he was a particularly talented English student and enjoyed poetry and plays. I suppose the last connection we've had with Cillian is that Cillian edited a book with Pat Dolan and Julian Brown and Mark Brennan called Unvo. It's the Empathy Book of Ireland. And it's really, I suppose, trying to bring empathy into everyday life. And they presented each school with one of these books from Mercer Press. And Cillian's is the first, chapter in the book. So he's a patron of the UNESCO Child and Family Resource Centre in University Galway. And so he's really interested in the arts, performing, but also helping out young children and families. So he's always giving back, which is something that we're really, really proud of, you know?
Okay, and we're seeing a lot of actors now who would be of certain notoriety on the silver screen, making the jump across to TV as well. I note that Cillian was one of the earlier ones who did that with Peaky Blinders. We're now seeing the likes of Woody Harrelson and Billy Bob Thornton, Kevin Costner, all of the big stars of the silver screen now making the consumable TV shows. But when you look at something like Peaky Blinders or Yellowstone, absolutely huge all over the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose Cillian's acting really came from the stage, where he worked with Cork Ó Duirce and other theatre productions. And, you know, they moved around. So I suppose he really learned his craft on the boards, you know, and got opportunities then on the big screen. And I suppose With the new streaming services, you know, there's such opportunities to go onto the small screen. So I suppose Killian's sort of showed his skills and variety as an actor, being able to do the three performances, you know.
Okay, and of course he's equally proficient on the boards and has professed his love for any acting role, be it silver screen, be it TV, or even in theatre. His love for English and poetry is evident from his English teachers, but I believe, and I hope I don't put you on the spot here, I believe he may have got suspended maybe once or twice.
Well, listen, I wasn't a principal at the time, so that wouldn't have been my responsibility at all, Mick. So that would have been a previous presentation, brother or brothers, maybe. And so I suppose, listen, Killian is probably, you know, a very artistic person. And so you could say that the structures of you know, an organization like a school with 700 pupils, he might have found a little bit difficult, but, you know, he was minded and protected, and that's all the school could do. But if he couldn't follow all the rules all the time, then I suppose the school had to follow its procedures. So I got to support the former principals for that. But I'm sure Killian would understand that as well, as a parent know of, you know, teenage children, you know.
Yeah, apparently he was out in Ballintemple a couple of nights ago walking his dog, shook hands with a couple of people. One final comment. Cork stars are often self-deprecating, often humble, but within all of that, also fiercely proud of their Cork roots. I take Roy Keane, for example, but I also remember Killian when he was asked in London, what's the best city in the world for pubs? And he said, well, I'm from Ireland, so I'm not going to say London, am I? I'm going to say Cork City.
Yeah. Well, I suppose there's a pride in where you're coming from. And I suppose being able to be humble and to be supportive of your local community is something that would be really important if you're on the world stage. So I suppose Killian is very good with that, you know.
Okay, and do you think you'll persuade him to visit with the Oscar if he wins?
Well, listen, all we can do is extend the invite. I know that he has visited the school in the past after leaving, so we would be delighted for him to come back if he was successful with the Oscar, and we'd be delighted for him to come back even if he wasn't, to visit us with his Golden Globe, you know?
Okay, and will you promise no homework on the night? That might get him across the line.
We definitely promise no homework, you know, just for first years, though.
Okay? All right. Okay, presentation, Brothers College Principal David Barry. Thank you for coming on the program this morning. Thanks.
Thanks very much.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Conversation that matters.
And a very good morning from the Neil Prendeville Show at 10 minutes to 11 o'clock. Very quickly, William Wall is Killian Murphy's former English teacher in Prez and an author himself. Morning, William.
Good morning.
Okay, you also want to distance yourself from the temporary suspensions. That was before your time as well, is it?
It was before my time, yeah. He's on record as saying that he had decided to settle down by fifth year, which is when I took him over, as far as I remember, you know. So I think I got the more disciplined end of him.
But you gave him the nudge into getting involved in drama, and for that you must take a lot of satisfaction.
Well, that's what he says, and I have to believe him, you know. But, I mean, basically, he was a really good student of English. He's just one of those kids who got poetry, got Shakespeare, got novels, understood it, you know. And so it wasn't hard to teach him. And I could also see from the fact that he was a performer, you know, he had the band, the Sons of Mr. Green Jeans, and they played in the school a couple of times. You could see that he was a natural for performance, so it wasn't hard to encourage him to go into the arts, let's say.
Okay, but there's something about Killian Murphy, in whatever role you see him, there's just this commanding presence, this magnetic attraction to watching him. I mean, you couldn't take your eyes off him in Peaky Blinders. You can't take your eyes off him, as good as Robert Downey Jr.'s performance was, and I think deserves the Best Supporting Actor. I'm not even sure if he was nominated. Absolutely outstanding performance. But you just couldn't take your eyes off Killian Murphy.
No, you couldn't. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I recently gave a talk about my work in a secondary school in Italy. And at the end of the session, there were questions, and one of the questions was it true that I had taught Killian Murphy? And when I said it was, a group of people at the back almost passed out in ecstasy at the thought that they were in the presence of somebody who had been in the presence of somebody as great as Cillian Murphy. So,
meanwhile, you could have met him walking his dog in Bella Temple the other night.
That's Italy, you know.
You also said that he had a kind of an edginess about his persona.
Yeah, very definitely. And there was indeed in school as well. You know, he sort of balanced an anti-establishment attitude, anti-authoritarian attitude, with this deep interest in culture and the arts, you know. So, and he was a sort of a leader in his class in that regard as well, you know, a sort of edgy, not quite an awkward customer, but the customer who would come up with the awkward questions.
Okay, and he was in a band, of course, as well, the Sons of Mr. Green Jeans. I know.
Yeah, the Sons of Mr. Green Jeans. They were actually fantastic. I'll tell you a story. They gave my wife, who encouraged the. She was a maths teacher in the school. She encouraged the music a lot, you know. And the band gave her a present of a demo tape, and which she had for several years. And then one day she came back. We'd been out someplace, and she said, "I'm going to play that demo tape." And at this stage, Cillian had been in the film of Disco Pigs. And so she went looking for the tape anyway, and one of her sons had overtaped the whole thing with summer music for himself, you know?
Yeah.
That was that tape gone.
In the days before, you know, the electronic filing and all that kind of thing, when we hold stuff on cassette tapes, I had a prized possession, which was an interview I did with Rory Gallagher, and I can't for the life of me remember who I gave it to, but it never came back.
Okay,
but you reckon from the start he was a fantastic actor, and you knew from his 16th year that he would end up, at least if not musically, he could have forked out and went that way, of course, but you kind of knew he was going to do something creative.
Yeah, definitely. He had to, you know. And he when he went into law in college, I was kind of surprised, really. Not surprised in that I knew he could be an excellent lawyer as well, you know. I could easily see him being a performing barrister in the four courts in Dublin. But I felt he should have gone into something to do with the arts. And I knew, in a way, I knew he would eventually. So when Disco Pigs came out, I was completely blown away by it. And I knew he had found his métier then, you know.
Okay, an Oscar nomination, not to mention the Screen Actors Guild, the Golden Globe, or the BAFTA, which there are nominations pertaining there as well. And an Oscar nomination alone would probably double your pulling power and your earning power. But of course he has it already. He's already one of the top leading men in the world now.
He is, and what I like about him, actually, is he's one of those actors, and there are few enough of them, who are extremely selective about what work he does. You know, he won't read scripts, and he'll pick the ones that he wants to do. He's very, very careful about it, and I think that's great, you know.
I think he shares that with his co-star in Oppenheimer, Matt Damon. I was watching an interview with Matt Damon. He's been very selective. He's going to do Bourne 6. But he's going to pick the director. It has to be a cracker of a story. I'm not doing it otherwise. He also didn't appear in one because he couldn't get the director he wanted. And he also starred in Oppenheimer. And him, both he and Robert Downey Jr. are just lauding Cillian Murphy's performance.
Yeah. He's an actor's actor as well, you know. He's up against Paul Giamatti, you know.
Unbelievable actor.
And he's a very similar character to Cillian in the sense that he said recently that he hates to play himself. You know, that could apply to Cillian as well. You know, that awkward stance in the presence of interviews and so on like that. That's really, that's kind of bread in the bone with him.
He's played parts. I couldn't imagine Cillian playing. Like, he played a part called Pig Vomit, who was the program director for Howard Stern in Private Parts. But he's also played Chuck Rhodes in Billions, which was an absolute fantastic performance, along with Damian Lewis. William, I got to go to news at 11 o'clock. Congrats on your appointment in May 2021 as Cork's Poet Laureate. I know you've been prolific in your writing since then. And thanks for coming on this morning.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And we will all be keeping our fingers crossed here in Prez, Cork and in Ireland that Cillian will bring home the Oscar on the 10th of March. And that's about it for episode 2, isn't it, Stephen?
It is indeed. A big thank you to all our teachers here in Prez for their patience, and especially to our guests, Mr. Martin Garvey, Mr. Shane Toomey, for their time, to Ali Khan, to the Cork public for contributing to our Vox Pop feature on Parky Cueve, to Red FM for allowing us to use their interview with Mr. David Barry and Mr. William Wall, and to PBC Management also, of course, for their continued support and encouragement of PBC Podcast. Last but not least, huge thanks to Elaine Smith for sound production and to Mr. Olinchig, who produces the show.
Absolutely, Stephen. Hear, hear. Episode 3 of PBC Podcast is now in production, dear listeners. But from episode 2, it's time to say goodbye.
It's bye from me, Stephen.
And bye from me, Matthew.